This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Yes. Isn't my voice sexy? Thank you so much for being here at 11 o'clock to prove that to be true. Sunday morning wake-up call here on WNRN, listening all around Central Virginia, including Levingston's 94.7. And let's take a moment and thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for supporting us today. You can find them specializing in Gore-Tex outdoor footwear from Merrell, the North Face, and Vasque, as well as guaranteed fitting. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville, at Wintergreen, the Chesterfield Town Center, and on West Broad Street in Richmond, and at BRMS.com. So a shout out to them for letting us be here today. We're going to be talking about a topic that has grown ever greater, food allergies. Our guest today, Dr. Peter Heyman, professor of pediatrics, who specializes in allergies and immunology. Doctor, how are you?
Good, thanks, and it's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to the hour.
Well, and so am I. And so are thousands, hundreds of thousands of listeners, because you know you can be listening online as well. You can call us up with your question or your comment, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Send us your message online, WNRN Studio, with the AOL instant message. So keep going, because I think we're going to have lots of questions or comments throughout the day. Because, Doctor, how long have you been specializing in, I mean, is this something that you left med school working on, is allergies and immunology?
No, I started out in general pediatrics, and from there started specializing in allergic disorders in children, for the last 25 years.
And what led you to move from general pediatrics into this specialty?
I was in general pediatrics at the University of Virginia and started to cover the asthma clinic, which is one of the allergic disorders, and took a strong interest in that, and then stepped back from a faculty position and did a fellowship in allergy and immunology, and things evolved from there.
But was there something that, was there a specific incident or a recognition on your part that made you go into the asthma clinic?
The asthma clinic was previously covered by an allergist and immunologist who was on the faculty who left, and I helped fill in a gap. But I also have probably had a special interest in airway disorders and lung diseases for years prior to that. And I think what has always appealed to me about trying to be helpful in allergic diseases is that, on one hand, it's not the most frequent cause of death, but is one of the most prominent sources of making it difficult to live comfortably and healthfully and productively if you have allergic diseases.
Well, let's start there. I mean, I will go back, and we certainly need to talk about how an allergy works and the difference between an allergy and an intolerance. But one of the reasons that I invited you on today was, it seems as though over the last decade or two that there are a lot more people suffering from an allergy, at least children. I mean, you at some point, airlines stopped giving out peanuts and gave out pretzels because of peanut allergies. At some point, being in the food industry, lots of restaurants or bakeries or food businesses had to put up signs that said, peanuts and peanut oils are used in this business, or this food may have been cooked in the same area as a peanut. And it's not just peanuts. That's an easy one to pick on. But now there's entire sections of grocery stores that are, have gluten-free items. It just seems to me that in the last decade or two, that so many more people have these. So is it true that there's a larger number of people that now suffer from these allergies than before?
In short, the answer is yes. But there are probably lots of reasons for it, and it's not entirely clear whether the prevalence of allergies is actually increasing or whether we're just getting better at being able to test with and document them. And as we get better in with our testing and our recognition of allergies, then the public becomes more aware of it, and that in turn brings more people in to see doctors and healthcare professionals to get evaluated for allergies. So part of it is better testing, better methods, increased awareness and recognition probably in part accounts for the increased prevalence. There are also interests in lifestyle changes that have occurred over the last decade or two and how that may have contributed to an increased prevalence of these disorders.
What do you mean by that?
Well, allergies is probably better defined as a disorder rather than a disease. Most people who have allergies are going to live a normal, healthy life span, but their symptoms will compromise their ability to function. The causes for these allergic diseases is a combination of having the genes that give you an increased risk for allergies, but those genes are silent until you're exposed to something in your environment that brings these, activates these genes and brings out the symptoms. So it's fair to say that lifestyles have changed over the last 2 to 3 decades. I'll give you an example. Through the 1940s and 50s, we used to spend much more of our life outside of the home than we do now. The two things that brought people more inside of their homes are air conditioning and television. Over the last couple of decades, estimates are that the large majority of Americans spend over 90% of their time indoors. And that's a lifestyle change that means different exposures, and those exposures are going to recruit and activate more genes and cause symptoms than the kinds of exposures we had in decades past. As far as what we eat is concerned, back in the 1950s and 60s when I was a child, the types of restaurants that you could go in and eat at were much more limited. I think I ate at my first Chinese restaurant in the late 1960s, early 70s. Children today are getting exposed to a larger variety of restaurants and cuisines and eating things than they used to, and which is another reason why food allergies may have increased.
So things that you might not have ever had when you were growing up to find out that you were allergic to it, now you might be able to have before you're 10 years old?
I'll give you an example in the field of nut allergies. You mentioned peanut, but there are also a variety of nut allergies, tree nut allergies that are increasing. When I started out in this field, our routine tests for nut allergies were pretty much focused on things like cashews, almonds, pecans, peanuts, and walnuts. Now we have to consider that many people are eating hazelnuts, pine nuts, pistachios. Seeds are becoming more prominent, sesame seeds, sunflower seeds. So we eat a much more varied diet with the potential of encountering food allergens now in the last decade or two than we did 2 to 3 to 4 decades ago. So that's another factor that creeps into the picture.
We already have a call. Let me push all the right buttons, and we have Susan from Richmond. Susan, are you there?
I'm here.
Thank you so much for holding on. And Dr. Heyman, you can hear Susan?
Yes, I can.
All right, fire away, Susan.
Okay, I am a mom to an almost 6-year-old son who has been diagnosed with eosinophilic esophagitis, also known as allergic esophagitis. And I've been a little disappointed in his treatment. All they want him to do is swallow steroids, and they're not looking for the cause of the allergy. Could you tell me why that might be?
Right. So there is yet another reason why the prevalence of food allergy is increasing, meaning we're becoming more aware of different types of disorders that are food-related. So with eosinophil esophagitis that you just referred to, that was a disease or disorder that allergists were really not seeing very much of a decade or two ago. Most of those symptoms, which are gastrointestinal, wind up in clinics handled by gastroenterologists. So it was not necessarily viewed to be an allergic disorder. Now it is, and so now it's added to the increased prevalence of allergies. Eosinophil esophagitis is a more difficult allergic disorder to both diagnose and manage.
Let me jump in real quick. Mm-hmm. Exactly what are you allergic to if you suffer from that?
Right. So can I backtrack a little bit and
sure.
give you a little bit of a feeling for allergic symptoms and what organs in our body are the most vulnerable, including the esophagus?
Hey, Susan, I'm going to hang up and let you listen on air, okay?
Okay, thank you.
So when I mentioned allergies are a disorder rather than a disease, the allergic response in most cases involves our immune system. And our immune system is set up to help protect us against infections. And one arm of the immune system evolved and was set up to help us fight parasite infections. We don't think of parasite infections very much in the United States, but historically, over the centuries and even in underdeveloped parts of our world, parasites are still a major cause of illness. It involves a part of the immune system that stimulates the same response that food allergens and respiratory allergens stimulate. And there's even a hypothesis that people who are allergic to foods and respiratory allergens probably handle parasite infections better than the rest of us, which may be why the field of allergy or allergic symptoms evolved. Parasites tend to infect three organs in our body, the gastrointestinal tract, the skin, and the respiratory tract. That's how parasites gain entry to our body. And there are cells in those organs, allergy cells, that help fight and kill parasites. Unfortunately, those same cells, if you're allergic to foods and respiratory allergens, get activated and cause symptoms. So in the gastrointestinal tract, the response to some foods is to cause allergy cells to migrate and get into the esophagus and cause inflammation. And those cells are called eosinophils, and that's why you mentioned your child has eosinophil esophagitis, or EE. One of the problems in, first of all, diagnosing EE is that the standard tests called skin tests sometimes are positive to the foods that cause the symptoms in the esophagus, which is often vomiting and difficulty swallowing. Sometimes those tests, however, are negative, and so it's very difficult for doctors to pinpoint the food that's causing it as easily, which is probably in part why your child is being treated with the steroids to swallow, whereas the proper treatment, if you knew for sure which foods were causing it, would be to avoid those foods. Another reason why it's difficult to avoid the right foods is that very often they're common foods, such as milk and soy, which, is a large number of products. And so the avoidance plan to avoid the foods that are causing the symptoms can sometimes be very complicated, and there again lead to inhaled steroids. I can tell you that this is one of the most active areas of research, and that there are more promising looks to the future as to how to treat EE, so certainly don't give up hope. And there are some indications that this problem may also improve with age, so your son who's 6 years old may also benefit from getting older and having decreased symptoms.
But Susan mentioned that, and Susan, I hope I'm remembering this properly, that the cure or the effort to do anything about it was strictly swallow steroids.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that's what she said when she went to the doctor. They just said, here, swallow these steroids to make things better.
Well, if that was the starting point, that probably is not the right starting point. Usually the whole scenario, and I think Susan probably has a better feel for what's in the background, is to first try to diagnose EE. And the way it's done is if you have the symptoms that are consistent with this food allergy, it leads to a biopsy and an exploration of the esophagus where you can see these cells called the eosinophils. And if they're greater than a certain number and the diagnosis is confirmed, then they really look to tests on the skin and the blood as the next step to try to see if they can get some clues about foods that could be avoided. And if that's been done and there's still confusion, then that's the right time to swallow steroids. But there always has to be an ongoing evaluation over time because it's not clear that he'll need steroids over the long haul.
979-0919 1-877-WNRN rocks. Your questions. Guest today on the wake-up call, Dr. Peter Heyman. He's a specialist in allergies and immunology. As we talk about food allergies, sort of the history and where we stand today, what seems to me to be a growing number of people suffering from allergies. And you said earlier that while that may be slightly true, there's also a part of just being better medically and identifying more people who are suffering. Are you born with this issue? You mentioned genes that may not be triggered until later in life. But I have a friend whose husband, you know, almost 30 years old, and it wasn't until the last 2 or 3 years that they determined that he had problems with gluten. Even though for years he was, you know, regularly upset when eating dinner. Let me go back even one step like you did. What are some of the signs of an allergy? I think people recognize difficulty breathing and a rash, you know, much like a poison ivy kind of rash. But there are other signs of what may be a food allergy, correct?
Right. So I think when our patients come and see us, the definition of an allergy can be quite different from how allergists and immunologists look at it. The broadest definition of an allergy is having an adverse or bad reaction to something in your environment. Sometimes it involves your immune system, sometimes it doesn't. And paying attention to the organs in the body that are affected can help you sort that out and help doctors sort it out in reference to your question about what symptoms should be looking for. Remember that the allergy cells that help us fight parasites that involve our immune system are concentrated in the skin, the airways, and the gastrointestinal tract. Interestingly, these same cells are also in the conjunctiva or lining of your eye, which is connected, interestingly, to your nasal mucosa.
When the cat gets on the pillow.
That's right. And so those patients can get what's called hay fever, which is allergic noses and allergic eye symptoms. But basically, the symptoms that involve the allergy cells and your immune system generally are concentrated in the skin. And in the skin, the symptoms will be things like hives and an itchy rash called eczema. In the respiratory tract, it involves allergic nose symptoms and asthma. In the eyes, the allergic eye symptoms are conjunctivitis, which, by the way, in Virginia is very seasonal in the spring, And in the gastrointestinal tract, the symptoms involve symptoms in your mouth, lip swelling, esophageal symptoms such as vomiting, stomach upsets, and sometimes diarrhea. So if a patient comes to our clinic and says, I think I'm allergic to something at work, because when I get there after an hour or two, I get a bad headache and my muscles ache. I think I'm allergic to something. That's to be taken very seriously. You wouldn't necessarily implicate the immune system or do allergy tests, the conventional allergy tests, but you would want to find out what's causing the symptoms that, with the headache, and you wouldn't refer them necessarily to an allergist like me. But if a patient comes in and complains of skin symptoms, respiratory symptoms, or GI symptoms, that usually tells you the immune system is involved and it's time to see an allergist. With food allergies, let me just say that 85% of the time that somebody is allergic to a food, it will cause skin symptoms first, usually hives or chronic eczema. However, 15% of the time, and that's not necessarily a small number, 15 to 20% of the time, the symptoms may not involve the skin at all and just cause breathing difficulties or gastrointestinal symptoms, similar to the person who called in and talked about eosinophil esophagitis. That's an example of symptoms in the esophagus that doesn't involve the skin at all. So you have to be open to variations in presentation.
11:21 on the wake-up call. Dr. Peter Heyman here as we talk about food allergies. He specializes in allergies and immunology. Dial us up if you have a question, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Online with your question, with your IMWNRN studio at AOL.com. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. There's a freeze watch this evening and early Monday morning in the valley. Otherwise, mostly cloudy and windy today, 30% chance of rain, highs 45 to 50. Clearing tonight, lows in the mid-30s, and even cooler in the valley. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 60 to 65. Chillier in the valley at upper 50s. Right now, clear and 44 over the mountains. Mostly cloudy in Lynchburg at 48 and 44 in Richmond. A few clouds in Charlottesville as well, where it's 46.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let's take a moment and thank Duo, a new and gently used contemporary clothing store in Charlottesville. Duo's fall shipments are arriving daily. You can also sell your gently used clothes at Duo. They're open Monday through Friday, 10 to 6, Saturdays, 11 to 5. That's Duo, 101 Elliewood Avenue in Charlottesville, or shop online at duo.com. And let's thank everybody who donated money in the recent fund drive. But if you haven't paid yet, please do so as soon as possible. People can take your payment and help you with your premiums are here until at least 7 on weekdays and sometimes on weekends if you call first. We're at 2250 Old Ivy Road in Charlottesville. Behind the Ivy Inn. If you're mailing, it's 22903. First round of written reminders with unpaid pledges have gone out. Thanks again to everybody who's already paid their pledge to help us reach over 93% collection rate. All right, back in action here with Dr. Peter Heyman as we talk about food allergies. Sean's out there waiting to take your call, 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. Doctor, we took a step back, but are you born with these allergies or can you get them later in life? Because again, a friend of mine, her husband, at some point in his late 20s, he finally said, gosh, I'm so uncomfortable when I'm eating. There must be something wrong. And looking for a more, I guess, recent health issue, they determined that he had a gluten problem. Mm-hmm. What's the proper frame for that, proper term?
It's called gluten sensitivity or celiac disease, which is yet a different source of food allergy, actually, or a different mechanism of food allergy. First, let me say, Rick, that yes, there's a genetic background that you're born with that puts you at increased risk for food allergies. And I'm going to get to gluten sensitivity and celiac disease in a minute, but food allergies tend to evolve early in life. There's a big difference between what goes on with children versus adults. So that children, when they become allergic, are most likely to show their symptoms in infancy and during the toddler years. And there is a panel of foods, seven of them, that trigger most of the symptoms 90% of the time or more. And they include foods like egg, milk, wheat, soy, peanut, fish, and shellfish. As you get older, symptoms can vary so that adults have a higher prevalence of what's called the food allergy syndrome, where they may eat certain raw fruits and vegetables that have proteins and allergens that cross-react with things they breathe, like birch pollen or ragweed pollen. We see that start to develop in childhood, in the school-age years and teenage years, but it's even more common in adults. Celiac disease is a little different. This is a disorder that strictly affects the gastrointestinal tract. No skin symptoms, no respiratory symptoms. It's sensitivity to a protein in wheat. It's also present in barley and rye called gliadin. And if you're sensitized to gliadin, and you have to have, by the way, the genetic predisposition for this, the symptoms you get are gastrointestinal cramping, diarrhea, and malabsorption. You can get some weight loss, and the proper way to diagnose it, again, is with a biopsy, often done by gastroenterologists. And what they see in your intestines is that the absorptive surface has been damaged. So it's been damaged by exposure to gliadin and wheat, and it doesn't absorb foods in general very well, and so you get symptomatic at that point, when it becomes severe, not just by wheat, by other foods that you can't absorb. But once you avoid the gliadin and wheat, then you can improve your symptoms dramatically. The diagnosis is done through a blood test, and the blood test is called, it's an antibody test against gliadin proteins called... I'm trying to remember the name. It'll come back to me. But it's a blood test, basically. And it's positive in about 98% of all people with wheat sensitivity who have celiac disease. It is not, by the way, a common disorder. It has come to be believed to be common because of the emergence of autism. There have been some reports that maybe there's more gluten sensitivity in autistic children. That turns out to be something quite different, and it's much less well documented than gluten sensitivity. Autistic children selectively may have some problems with gluten in wheat, and that metabolic abnormality may augment their autism, but I'll have to tell you that those reports are very anecdotal, very poorly studied. There's no test for that. That's not celiac disease, it's not gluten sensitivity, and I think the person you're referring to who developed it later in adulthood or maybe recognized it later in adulthood is not autistic and has a genetic predisposition to celiac disease.
I see one phone ringing, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks, also available as we talk about food allergies with Dr. Peter Hammond. Doctor, here's a question that came across on our instant message sign. Is how do you read food labels for celiac disease? So I guess sort of a best way to read food labels for those suffering from celiac disease.
Right. Reading food labels, and you'll notice I'm always going to drop back to a more generic problem that comes up in our clinic all the time. Reading labels can be very frustrating for people with food allergies. And the reason that it's frustrating is that companies who make foods are very concerned of avoiding any medical legal problems with the foods they're producing. So they're going to put a whole list of potential food contaminants in there that may or may not be realistic in terms of what food allergic people really have to avoid.
That's the sign on the door that says this food may have been made in the same kitchen with peanuts.
You hit the nail on the head. And it also, because of the large variety of new foods that are coming up, makes it very difficult for parents and physicians, including allergists, to keep up and give the right advice for every single food. So what's important for all people with food allergies to know about is the Food Allergy Network. The Food Allergy Network was created by parents of children with food allergies because they were frustrated about product labeling, and they knew that they couldn't always get the complete information from their doctors. And there is a website for the Food Allergy Network. It is www.foodallergy, that's a single word, foodallergy.org. And it's also got a new website called www.faan. It stands for the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network. So it's www.faan.org. They have great information about how to read food labels, alternative recipes, about how to treat anaphylaxis. They have what's going on in the area of research for allergic disorders. So people who have children or who have food allergies should know about this, and it'll help them read product labels. Now, with product labels, I have two bits of advice to give. One is that when you read a food label, the very few first few foods on the label are the ones that are most concentrated. And as you go down the line, it means that those foods or dyes or chemicals are less concentrated, and probably you don't have to be as worried about them. Secondly, I would try to avoid foods that have more than 5 or 6 ingredients. The longer the list of ingredients, the more highly processed these foods are, and the less control you have as a parent or a food allergic person about knowing what's in it and what amounts. So the less ingredients, the better. The FDA is now going to get involved and actually require companies not to include foods unless they contain a certain amount of them. That will help us tremendously. The last bit is to use your judgment and common sense. And so I'm going to use peanut as an example. If you're peanut allergic, you clearly wouldn't eat an M&M peanut. If you look at the food label for M&Ms, it may say that this is produced in the same plant as M&M peanuts and therefore could contain contamination. I might be a little wary of that. On the other hand, that same company makes hard candies across the street, and even those hard candies say could contain contamination with peanut because they're worried that maybe there's a worker in one plant with peanut M&Ms who comes across the street in the afternoon and works in the other plant. But as a parent, I think you probably know that that hard candy is highly unlikely to contain a lot of peanut protein, and I probably would use my judgment and not worry too much about it. So with gluten sensitivity, which was the original question, I think reading product labels, if it says it contains gluten and it's way down the list of ingredients, I might not worry too much about it. But if it's one of the first ingredients, or you can look at the food and you know that it probably has wheat in it, avoid it.
And foodallergynetwork.com. Dot net or dot com?
Dot org.
Dot org. Foodallergynetwork.org. Caller, just 1 second. Let me do this. I need to thank Ananda for support today. That's Charlottesville Community Center for Conscious Living and Alternative Healing Practices with a focus on mind, body integration, and soul level living. They offer massage and energy revitalization. Ananda off the downtown mall next to Vinegar Hill Theater. For more info, it's AnandaWellnessCenter.com. All right, we do have a caller if he hung tight. John from Coesville. John, did you hang around?
Yes, I did.
Thank you so much. What's your question or comment?
Thank you. Well, I'm not sure if it was answered or not. I was just listening to you talking about the peanut allergen or the allergic reaction. My girlfriend is has a reaction to nuts. And everything, you know, whenever we go shopping or anything, she'll look at a product, you know, that we've selected, and then at the last minute, oh, no, you know, it might have been made in a place that had nuts. Well, what I'm curious about is, like, for example, on her birthday, I want to get her a birthday cake, and I don't cook, you know. I don't know how to make a cake, and so I go to order one or find one, you know, one of the big Harris Teeter or whatever, or at a private bakery. And even just this morning, in fact, I was trying to pick one up and come to find out that it was made in a place that may contain peanut products. So my question is, how sensitive, how contaminated is, you know, I mean, like, what does it take for somebody who has that allergen to nuts to react to it? I mean, doesn't she have to eat a mouthful of peanuts or simply just, you know, walk by a package on the shelf, you know? Is there any way to determine whether, or is it a risk every time if she were to eat something that may, or that was made in a place that may have been contaminated with nuts?
Yeah, so that's a good question. First of all, reactions to all allergens, be they food allergens or allergens you breathe, there's tremendous individual differences from one person to the next. And, some people who are highly allergic and some people who are not so allergic. The best way to know with an individual is to know by their past history. So if, for example, she's had a personal experience where there was she had allergic symptoms again in her skin and respiratory tract or gut, or worse than that, to a very, very small amount of peanut, then I think she needs to be very careful. On the other hand, if she's not had that experience, she may not be one of these people who's very sensitive to it, and you don't have to be quite as careful.
She's had a very severe reaction in the past, you know, the throat closing, not being able to breathe and all that. So subsequently, she's been extremely careful over, you know, the last couple of decades. So, I mean, I guess there's just no way to know. Is that the deal when it's that's why the warning is?
Yeah, I think if she has that personal history, you have to be a little bit wary. What's interesting is there's a big difference between children and adults. We see more frequent food allergy symptoms to peanut, for example, in children than adults. The prevalence in children is about twice as high as adults, but it's not that common, by the way. It's about prevalence of 0.8 in children and 0.4 in adults. But the symptoms we see in kids is much less severe. Usually, as pediatricians, we'll see symptoms like hives, some vomiting, maybe some breathing difficulties. And yes, it can require a treatment in an emergency room, but life-threatening events in children are really, really quite uncommon, and I've never seen one in my 25 years of practice. I see my job is to keep kids out of the emergency room. The older you get, the risk for more serious symptoms increases. So if she's had a previous experience where she had a more significant reaction, it's doubtful that she's going to outgrow it, and I think she deserves to be helpful. I think it's important for her to be pretty clear from testing what nuts she's allergic to and what nuts she isn't. Is it just peanut or are there nuts she has to be aware of? Turns out that 1/3 of people who are allergic to peanuts are allergic to tree nuts, but 2/3 aren't. So you can really make things a lot easier if you know for sure what nuts she's sensitized to. If it's peanut, and that's the nut you're really talking about, again, I would keep in close touch with the Food Allergy Network in terms of quantities. They have an 800 number. I believe you can even communicate with them by email and ask just those kinds of questions. And they can tell you, look, you know, in the United States, we don't see a lot of reactions to cakes that have been produced in plants where there are peanuts. There really needs to be some peanut in there.
But I guess there really is no way to gauge whether or not she would get a reaction. That's correct, right?
That's correct. You don't know because...
I can't get her a birthday cake. I think I understand now why nobody's been able to give her a birthday cake.
In part, it's frustrating, and I think that's why the FDA wants to make a certain requirements as to how much peanut has to be in the product before a company can declare it.
Hey, John, let me step in here for a second. as someone who comes from the food business, there are a couple very nice bakeries here in this town, locally owned, that if you went to them, I can't believe that they couldn't provide you a cake that has worked for them in the past, because there are far too many people suffering from this allergy.
I just haven't researched it that far. I need
What bakeries are they? I mean, seriously, those bakeries are of interest.
Well, I don't want to, you know, send business to somebody and say, oh, well, Rick Moore on the wake-up call said that you could do it. But, you know, for example, Chandler's Bakery. Chandler's Bakery has been in this town for quite a long time. They're quite well-known. They're very positive in terms of what they do. And they do it in their kitchen. They don't, you know, and could Whole Foods provide that for you? Possibly, because they are well known for the many things that they provide, and celiac disease, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that many of their items come from a commissary kitchen. So could they provide that for you? I don't know. Chandler's may be able to do that for you if you ask, because of the ever-growing percentage of people suffering from this concern.
I think that's great. I think that's great advice in general, by the way, that if you go to businesses that are local in town and where they do their own baking, they can tell you much more accurately what's in it and what not. If you buy foods, as you mentioned, at Harris Teeter's, those are going to be commercially produced, and those companies are going to try to err on the side of staying out of trouble legally, and you'll be less in control of what you buy and what you eat.
And another business that does underwrite WNRN is Bluegrass Bakery downtown, which is well known for many vegetarian and vegan products. And so can that step over to the next concern about being, you know, allergy-free for what you need?
Certainly.
Possibly.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I just really hadn't looked into it far enough, I guess. I usually just buy it to, you know, the easiest places.
Break out the phone book, my man. Break out the phone book. All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, 11:42 here on the wake-up calls. We talk about food allergies with Dr. Peter Heyman. He's a doctor of pediatrics, specializes in allergies and immunology. Dial us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, and this week it's time to meet the local candidates for our upcoming elections. Too much traffic? Worried about water? The Hook helps you bone up on local issues, too. Shouldn't the Virginia Department of Forestry announce their plans before having large fires, even when controlled? Apparently, they don't think so. And does eating local food include hunting your local deer? Seems to be pretty popular. The Hook, an authentic experience. And let me give a shout out to Blue Ridge Graphics for supporting us. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, online, brgtshirts.com. And our friends at Alt Energy of Charlottesville, providing custom professional design and installation of solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems can pay for themselves and reduce your carbon footprint. More is at altenergyincorporated.com. And not that you would, but being 11:44, Les Temps Purdue here in 16 minutes. Drew Thompson will be here bringing the best of college, alternative, and underground scenes from the 80s and 90s. You'll hear early efforts from the biggest acts of today and cult classics you haven't heard in a long time. That's Les Temps Purdue at noon only on WNRN. All right, back in action here. Dial us up. Ask your question, 979-0919-1877. WNRN rocks. Dr. Heyman, all kinds of stuff going on here in the last little bit with these. Another person called in and asked, said that they are allergic to soft shell crabs, And what do you have to say about that?
Right. And by the way, I just remembered that test for celiac disease in the blood. It's called tissue transglutaminase, IgA. And when that's positive and you have the symptoms, then biopsies are usually done to verify that it's going to be important to avoid wheat, rye, and barley if you have celiac disease. So with soft shell crab, shellfish allergies are similar to nut allergies in that they're linked to foods that can cause more serious anaphylaxis as you get older. So we're always more wary in our older population of people who are allergic to peanut, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish as causing more serious symptoms. And with soft shell crab, I would guess that you also probably need to be a little bit concerned with crab in general. It's all in the crustacean family, so that people who are allergic to crab often have difficulty with shrimp and lobster. If it's unique to soft-shell crab, that's kind of interesting. There are allergens that are linked to the shell, between the soft part of the crab and the shell, and when the crab molts, it may accentuate these allergens, so perhaps there is more problems with soft-shell crabs. But in general, I think soft-shell crab allergy would be linked to crab allergy in general.
You know, at my business, the Forest Lakes Market, we do some catering for the private jet side of things. And when we feed the crews, when those orders are placed for, you know, provide us with some, you know, dinner for these crews, we're specifically told not to provide anything with shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that would be a bad thing if you find out when you're 50 that you're suddenly, you said later in life, that you're suddenly have become allergic to a shellfish and you're flying the plane. Not such a good thing.
Correct. So, children are often sensitized to things like egg, milk, wheat, and soy, and they cause allergic symptoms in infancy and toddlers, and most of those kids will become tolerant and be able to eat those foods by the time they start school, even though their tests stay positive. For some reason, the opposite happens with shellfish, peanut, tree nuts, and fish in general, meaning you can be sensitized and have positive tests to these foods in childhood and then lose your tolerance as you're an adult. It looks like you have a new allergy, but usually the sensitization occurs very early in life. So when adults are allergic to these foods, shellfish included, not only are you concerned about the symptoms in the skin, the gastrointestinal tract, and lungs, but anaphylaxis in general. What anaphylaxis is when these allergy cells in the skin and in the gastrointestinal tract and in the lungs and even the blood get activated all at the same time, you can get profound symptoms of hypotension and also symptoms of respiratory collapse and respiratory failure. That's called serious anaphylaxis, and that's treated in the emergency room and can sometimes be life-threatening. What's important for our patients to know about is that this, fortunately, is not very common. In the entire United States, there are about 200 food-related deaths annually. So it's more dangerous for me to drive home today after the show. Among those 200 people, the large majority, 90%, are over 10 years of age. So again, this is more of an adult problem than a pediatric problem. If only 10% are under 10 years of age, that means only 20 kids in the United States. Again, I've never seen a life-threatening food reaction in a kid in 25 years. I see lots of hives, lots of vomiting, and respiratory difficulties that are treated successfully in the emergency room when these kids go home. But it's the adults with shellfish, fish, peanut, and tree nut allergies that have to be more careful.
You mentioned, by the way, Dr. Peter Heyman here as we talk about food allergies. His pediatrics specializes in allergies and immunology. If you have a question or a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks 1150 here on the Wake Up Call. Doctor, you talk about the kids going to school. What are your thoughts about how, in some ways, the culture as a whole has changed in allowance of people suffering from an allergy? We've taken the airplanes and taken peanuts off the airplanes and started pretzels. Is there anything similar to that in the school system where the majority population is asked or forced to change their settings because of the minority populations? How does that happen in the school system, not having any kids myself?
Mm-hmm. Right. So school systems vary in terms of how they handle this. In part, it probably has to do with what kind of pressure parents with food allergic kids put on the schools and the school systems. I think that there's a heightened awareness of peanut allergy now. Certainly if there is a life-threatening event, it becomes newsworthy. If I mentioned there may be only 20 life-threatening events in kids each year, that's not a frequent problem, but if it happens, it becomes newsworthy. It's sort of like a shark attack. After a shark attack, nobody wants to go in the water. At schools, however, because it's potentially a serious problem, I think it's fair for schools in their own lunch menus not to be serving peanut.
But that doesn't stop me from sending my kid, to school with a homemade peanut brownie.
That's correct. And I think that's where schools vary, and I'll have an opinion, but you need to know that it's an opinion. If schools don't serve peanut products, and if they have the emergency treatment for an allergic reaction to foods in schools, which is EpiPen, it's an emergency epinephrine thing that can be given, then I don't think that children with peanut allergies should be isolated at separate tables from other kids who are bringing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Does that happen in some school systems?
There are some schools that actually will put kids who have peanut allergies at separate tables. That alters their lifestyles and chances for friendships for something that is probably over the top in terms of the realities of food allergy. And here's how that thinking evolves. Is if a child with peanut allergy touches another kid's peanut butter and jelly sandwich, doesn't eat it, they may break out with hives locally on their hands. It's just like doing a little skin test if we scratch the skin with peanut allergy. It's a contact reaction. The response of the school is, oh my gosh, that child touched a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, got a rash. Imagine what would have happened if they would have eaten it. That, however, is not the case. What happens on the skin does not reflect what's going to happen in the gastrointestinal tract. And I get calls about this all the time. So I don't think that children who attend schools with kids who have peanut allergies should be restricted in bringing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to school. I don't think the kids should be isolated at separate tables if they have peanut allergy, unless it's very clear that they've had a very significant reaction to a small amount of peanut, which is probably not that common. But I do think it's fair for the schools not to serve peanut products in their own menus.
How do you help a parent of a child suffering from one of these allergies we've talked about? How do you help a parent teach their child to be sort of self-sufficient out in the world at that age? I mean, you would assume that, you know, not all six-year-olds are going to make the best decisions.
Right.
I mean, all 50-year-olds that make the best decisions about what they should
eat. So it varies with age in terms of how you work with parents and children. Up until the time children start school, their diet is pretty well controlled by the family. The only time that an infant and toddler preschool child runs the risk of an accidental exposure is when they go over to grandparents' house or neighbor's house. If they go to restaurants, or sometimes accidents happen on vacations, that's where parents want to have their EpiPens available to treat a reaction. In schools, we teach kids with peanut allergy not just to avoid nuts in general, because it's very difficult for a school-aged child, and particularly their friends, to distinguish a peanut from a cashew. So although they may be able to eat cashews at home if they're peanut allergic, and they are not allergic to cashews. In school, they're taught no nuts in general. Once you become a teenager, you become quite independent of your parents and what you eat and what you don't eat. And in our own practice, we always like to see our peanut allergic kids back in our clinic when they're about 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age, so we can sit down one-on-one with them, reevaluate their peanut allergy, show them that it hasn't gone away, even though they haven't had a reaction, and that they need to be start to be thinking themselves about protecting themselves and know what questions to ask. So we start working one-on-one with our teenagers and young adults. So if I mentioned that significant anaphylactic reactions are uncommon under the age of 10, in fact, they become much more common in teenagers and young adults in their 20s and 30s. And that's the population we work hardest with for self-education. Education is very important, and knowing about the Food Allergy Network is very important for our teenagers and young adults.
11:56 on the wake-up call with Dr. Peter Heyman as we wind down our hour talking about food allergies. I have time for one phone call if you'd like to be that person. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Doctor, I've never been tested. How would I tell, or what would make me consider going in because I'm lactose intolerant? Someone told me that because I clear my throat a lot. Oh, you know, you got to quit drinking milk or, you know, something similar to that. Not so much cheese. That's what causes that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel bad. I just have to clear my throat a lot.
Yeah. So the most common problems with milk are actual food allergies where your immune system reacts. And again, remember your skin, your respiratory tract, and your gut, so that clearing your throat wouldn't necessarily make you think of that kind of food allergy. Lactose intolerance is a food intolerance, and it is caused by a deficiency in the enzyme that breaks down and helps you digest lactose. That's the milk sugar. And that's in your lower intestinal tract, that enzyme. So, again, not related to throat clearing. I think it's important to mention these symptoms to your doctor and let them help you out. But I think if you said you had gastrointestinal bloating, cramping, and diarrhea, they'd think of lactose intolerance and have you drink lactose-free milk. If you ever think you might be lactose intolerant, then try drinking lactose-free milk or lactate-treated milk. And if you still have the symptoms, then it's not lactose intolerance.
All right, 11:58. Last question. Here's a question someone sent in. How can biotechnology help us in the future?
That's still speculative. There is some thinking that with some genetic engineering, we might be able to modify foods, but I don't think we're all that enthusiastic about having our foods modified. But biotechnology also is teaching us how we can take conventional treatments like allergy shots and take those allergens and identify which part of those proteins, which part of the allergens cause symptoms, and genetically engineer just those parts so you can use them in treatments for allergy shots without causing any risks of reactions from allergy shots but still treating the disease. Same is true for some foods like peanut allergy. If they can figure out through bioengineering just the peanut proteins that people could take orally to desensitize themselves, those are some hopes for the future.
All right, we got a call here late. I'm sorry, Kathleen from Stanton, just a little too late in the hour. Send me an email with your question if it's important to you. I'll be glad to pass it on to Dr. Heyman. Abstractme@AOL.com, A-B-S-T-R-A-C-T-M-E. At AOL.com. The show will also be podcast at SevillePodcast.com. Put your question up there. I'll direct Dr. Heyman to that as well. Doctor, thank you so much for coming on today. I found it fascinating.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Next week, Dr. Jody Kilbasa will be here as we talk about the upcoming Virginia Film Festival. Drew's here next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.